The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the Associated Press. First of all, an article from the Religion News Service published on the 18th of November entitled, Texas Megachurch, White's Chapel, Departs the United Methodist Church to Anchor New Methodist College, by Lynn Hollers and Emily McFarland Miller, Southlake, Texas. Members of White's Chapel United Methodist Church, a large congregation in this wealthy Dallas suburb, overwhelmingly voted earlier this month to disaffiliate from the United Methodist Church, part of the ongoing defection of conservative Methodists from the second largest Protestant denomination in the U.S. over questions of sexuality. White's Chapel fits that bill. Southlake is no stranger to the polarizing debates about critical race theory in schools, about gun rights, and LGBTQ rights. But the congregation is no stranger to competing ideas either, and says it does not plan to join the Global Methodist Church, the new conservative denomination offering a home to like-minded United Methodists. Rather, White's Chapel hopes to create what they call a Methodist Collegiate College, envisioned to create a new form of connectionalism, one of shared ministry, equal accountability, and practical governance. And it's hoping other churches might join in time. We want to work together, and we want to be a healing agent between all Methodism, said the Reverend John McKellar, co-pastor of White's Chapel. McKellar hopes White's Chapel, which sees close to 6,000 attendees weekly, can become an example of respectful discourse and find pockets of unity in an era of polarization, he said. People have very different opinions and thoughts on politics and on different theological ideas. If we can't find a common ground and worship together, what are we modeling for the rest of the nation? He asked. The Reverend Todd Renner, who co-pastors with McKellar, thinks White's Chapel isn't alone in seeking moderation. He sees the Global Methodist Church as more conservative and the existing UMC as more progressive than those of us that are kind of moderate. Many, if not most, of the bigger United Methodist churches, Renner said, have congregants all across the political spectrum. The vote at White's Chapel on November the 7th, the day before the midterm election, brought 2,505 members to the church, which was open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. They filed inside past security and into the church lobby, where suites were laid out on a table and fellow congregants were chatting. Voting took place in a separate room, and voters cast their votes on an electronic voting machine. The result was lopsided, with 2,338 voting to disaffiliate, 160 voting against, and 7 abstaining. The pastors of White's Chapel say they've heard from other in-between churches who are interested in a more centrist conference, but they declined to share what churches that might be. The Reverend J. Therrell, president of the Wesleyan Covenant Association, which advocates for UMC conservatives and is aligned with the Global Methodist Church, said the group is happy that White's Chapel has voted to disaffiliate and believes it's best for the future of the Southlake Church. While we wish that White's Chapel and all disaffiliating churches would join the robust future of the Global Methodist Church, we understand that some are soured on denominations because of the mistreatment of the United Methodist Church. The GMC's doors will always be open, and we hope that one day we will all be together, Therrell said. The Reverend Keith Boyette, head of the Global Methodist Church, said he expected that some churches that disaffiliate may remain independent for a time while discerning whether to join a new denomination. He said there is no comprehensive list of churches engaged in the process of disaffiliating from the UMC, but he believes that number is approaching 2,000. Since the denomination was launched in May, he said in an email to RNS, hundreds of churches have already become congregational members of the Global Methodist Church, and hundreds more are in the process of doing so. White's Chapel's disaffiliation still must be approved by the Central Texas Annual Conference, the regional governing body. In September, a special session of the annual conference approved 81 churches' resolutions to disaffiliate. The conference next meets in June. White's Chapel's vote was held in accordance with the disaffiliation plan approved by a special session of the UMC's National General Conference in 2019, along with legislation called the Traditional Plan, which strengthened the denomination's language barring the ordination and marriage of LGBTQ United Methodists. Though many expected LGBTQ United Methodists and their allies to exit the denomination as a result, they vowed to remain and resist. Instead, mostly conservative Methodists are leaving the UMC. The disaffiliation plan allows church members to vote to leave the denomination through the end of 2023. The resolution must be approved by the church's annual conference, and the church must pay 2 years of apportionments and pension liabilities, but it can retain ownership of its buildings and land. Annual conferences may add their own requirements for disaffiliation, and groups like the Wesleyan Covenant Association have argued that some annual conferences are adding onerous and punitive requirements for disaffiliation to prevent churches from leaving. The Central Texas Annual Conference could not immediately be reached to discuss what it requires from departing congregations. White's Chapel says this was the right time for them financially to pay out. The church's primary concern, its co-pastor McKellar said, was to move forward with its eyes on its religious mission without the trying politics of either the UMC or its politically minded neighbors. There are a lot of churches in our community that endorse candidates, said McKellar. They get involved in these issues. We are not that. We want to be that middle place, united around Jesus. We now have an article from the Associated Press that was published on the 18th of November entitled, Maryland Probe Finds 158 Abusive Priests, Over 600 Victims, by Brian Witt, Annapolis, Maryland. An investigation by Maryland's Attorney General identified 158 Roman Catholic priests in the Archdiocese of Baltimore who have been accused of sexually and physically abusing more than 600 victims over the past 80 years, according to court records filed on November the 17th. Attorney General Brian Frosch announced that his office has completed a 463-page report on the investigation, which began in 2019. He filed a motion in Baltimore Circuit Court to make the report public. Court permission is required because the report contains information from grand jury subpoenas. It's unclear when the court will make a decision. For decades, survivors reported sexual abuse perpetrated by Catholic priests, and for decades, the church covered up the abuse rather than holding the abusers accountable and protecting its congregations, according to the court filing. The Archdiocese of Baltimore was no exception. The report, titled Clergy Abuse in Maryland, identifies 115 priests who were prosecuted for sex abuse and or identified publicly by the Archdiocese as having been credibly accused of sexual abuse. It also includes an additional 43 priests accused of sexual abuse, but not identified publicly by the Archdiocese. The report summarizes the sexual abuse and physical torture perpetrated by all 158 priests and the Archdiocese's response to that abuse. the court filing said. In a letter released on November the 17th, Archbishop William Laurie of Baltimore apologized to the victim survivors who were harmed by a minister of the church and who were harmed by those who failed to protect them, who failed to respond to them with care and compassion, and who failed to hold abusers accountable for their sinful and criminal behavior. Upon reading today's motion, we feel renewed shame, deep remorse, and heartfelt sympathy, most especially to those who suffered from the actions of representatives of the very church entrusted with their spiritual and physical well-being, Laurie wrote. David Lorenz, the Maryland leader of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priest, described the news of the report and number of victims as absolutely horrendous. Once again, the church has lied about the number of abusive priests, Lorenz said in a statement. Many parishes were dumping grounds for predators. Some housed almost 10. It is very clear that nobody was safe. Sadly, it is no different than any diocese or secular report in the country. While the court filing noted that more than 600 victims were identified, it also said there are almost certainly hundreds more, as the Department of Justice's annual crime victimization report has demonstrated that most incidents of sexual assault go unreported. Both boys and girls were abused, according to the court filing, with ages ranging from preschool through young adulthood. Although no parish was safe, some congregations and schools were assigned multiple abusive priests, and a few had more than one sexually abusive priest at the same time, the court filing said. One congregation was assigned 11 sexually abusive priests over 40 years. The sexual abuse was so pervasive, the court filing said, that victims were sometimes reporting sexual abuse to priests who were perpetrators themselves. The investigation also revealed that the archdiocese failed to report many allegations of sexual abuse, conduct adequate investigations of alleged abuse, remove abusers from the ministry, or restrict their access to children. Instead, it went to great lengths to keep the abuse secret, the court filing said. While the archdiocese reported a large number of allegations to police, especially in later years, for decades it worked to ensure that the perpetrators would not face justice. In the court filing, Frosch argues that publicly airing the transgressions of the church is critical to holding people and institutions accountable and improving the way sexual abuse allegations are handled going forward. More importantly, it is vital to protecting children and the entire community, the filing said. The court filing also noted that of the 43 priests that had not been publicly identified or prosecuted, 30 have died. For those priests that have died, this additional secrecy interest is less compelling, the report said. The Attorney General's office redacted all identifying information for the 13 living church officials who've been accused of sexual abuse, but who have not been listed as credibly accused by the archdiocese and who have not been prosecuted. In 2019, Frosch launched a criminal investigation of child sexual abuse perpetrated by priests and other employees of the Archdiocese of Baltimore. Hundreds of thousands of documents dating back to the 1940s were produced in response to grand jury subpoenas. As part of its investigation, the Attorney General's office created an email address and telephone hotline for people to report information. Over 300 people contacted the office, and investigators interviewed hundreds of victims and witnesses. The next article is from the Religion News Service, published on November the 18th. It is entitled, "The Twitter Exodus. As a Christian minister, I can no longer stay." This opinion piece was written by Reverend Dr. Chuck Curie, who is the Pacific University Chaplain Emeritus and a minister in the United Church of Christ. Elon Musk's Twitter is crashing faster than a self-driving Tesla out for a drive on a fall day. For people of faith concerned about the health of democracy and the common good, the question now is whether or not to join the Twitter exodus. I've been on social media for nearly 20 years, but with the explosion of misinformation and hate now spread by verified accounts on Twitter, I've deleted the Twitter app. As long as Musk is in charge without restraints or oversight, I'll be away. Trust me, the decision was not easy. Without question, Twitter is my most valuable piece of social media real estate. I got started on social media with a blog back in 2003 when few religious progressives were online. The site quickly took off with positive mentions in media outlets like the LA Times and the Washington Post. Eventually, blogging became microblogging, and Twitter was born. Facebook is where we reconnect with high school and college friends. Twitter, for me, has been the national water cooler where connections to colleagues and legacy media have been deepened. Twitter is as important as any pulpit I've held. More importantly, however, social media has been used successfully to divide Americans. Much of Russia's interference with U.S. elections has involved using social media to exploit those divisions. As the midterm elections neared, the National Council of Churches issued a statement noting that they were gravely concerned about the current political climate. The violent rhetoric that has replaced honest political debate, and potential for violence during and after this year's election. The statement continues, "This includes concerns about the possible upticks in anti-Muslim, anti-Jewish, and racist rhetoric, bigotry, and violence, as well as violent attacks against political figures because of their positions on the issues. Such attacks jeopardize our democracy and cause unnecessary harm." Hate speech has soared on Twitter since Musk took over. One racial slur was used 26,228 times in tweets and retweets in Musk's first week, which was triple the 2022 average, reports Axios in a new study from the Center for Countering Digital Hate. Christianity should be, I believe, about building up the ideal of the beloved community. In Ephesians 4:29, we read, "Let no evil talk come out of your mouths, but only what is good for building up, as there is need, so that your words may give grace to those who hear." Social media doesn't lend itself to such ideals, which I myself have fallen short of too many times to count. But God is not finished with any of us yet. My vision, however, is not shared by all. Prominent Christians like Franklin Graham use Twitter to, among other things, push hate directed at gays and lesbians. White Christian nationalists use Twitter to help organize the January 6th insurrection. Why not stay on Twitter to continue preaching a progressive understanding of the Christian faith? Musk's vision prioritizes profit over informed dialogue. His Twitter Blue subscription service provides anyone with verification, the blue check, for a fee. That fee will promote tweets from hateful voices and anonymous accounts over and against the rest of us. Neo-Nazi Richard Spencer, who lost his verified status after the far-right rally in Charlottesville, recently purchased a new verified account under Musk's scheme. Don't be surprised to see Donald Trump and others, once kicked off Twitter for their calls of sedition and violence against democracy, rejoin the platform. The NAACP is asking companies that advertise on Twitter to pause their efforts. Companies that have agreed, including United Airlines, Audi, Mondelez, Pfizer, and Chipotle, should be applauded. As for me, I am still looking for a Twitter alternative. What we need in the United States is a publicly owned social media outlet that fosters real conversation and sustained debate over critical issues, and weeds out hate while promoting democratic values. Will you join the Twitter exodus? Our last article was originally published in The Conversation and reprinted in the Religion News Service on the 10th of November. It is entitled, What is the Rosary? Why a Set of Beads and Prayers Are Central to Catholic Faith, by Kayla Harris. It's one of the most famous moments in modern Catholicism, the apparition of Our Lady of Fatima. The Virgin Mary allegedly appeared to three Portuguese children in 1917, when much of the world was engulfed in World War II. Over a series of six appearances, Mary emphasized to these young shepherds that to bring peace, they should pray the rosary every day. Devotion to the rosary already had a centuries-old history, and the Marian apparition at Fatima only deepened it. So, what is a rosary, and why is it so important to so many Catholics? Centuries of meaning. As an archivist and associate professor for the University of Dayton's Marian Library, I curate a collection of artifacts that illustrate many forms of popular devotion to the Virgin Mary, including nearly 900 unique rosaries. Each one tells a story of the people who own them and how rosaries have evolved. The word rosary refers to a set of prayers in the Catholic Church, as well as a physical object. While praying the rosary, Catholics use a set of beads or knots to count and keep track of the prayers. Prayer beads as physical counting tools are quite common in several religions, including Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. The exact origins of the rosary are debated. Many theologians believe it was at least popularized by Saint Dominic de Guzman, a Spanish mystic and priest who allegedly received a vision in 1208 of the Virgin Mary, in which she presented him with the rosary. The Catholic Church celebrates the Feast of Our Lady of the Rosary on October the 7th each year, previously known as the Feast of Our Lady of Victory, to commemorate a Christian victory in a naval battle in 1571. Soon after, Pope Gregory VIII changed the title of the Holy Day, and now the entire month of October is dedicated to the Rosary. One prayer per bead. To pray the Rosary, a person will begin by holding the crucifix, make a sign of the cross over their chest, and recite the Apostles' Creed, which lays out the basics of Christian faith, such as that Jesus is the Son of God and rose from the dead. Generally, a rosary will contain five groups of 10 beads, each known as a decade. When touching each of these beads, the user will recite a Hail Mary prayer. At the completion of each decade is a slightly larger bead, which is a cue to recite the Lord's Prayer, another of the most important prayers in Christianity, and to meditate on one of the 20 mysteries, which are significant events in the life of Jesus and Mary. The decade is completed by saying the Glory Be to the Father prayer, and after completing all five decades, the user recites the Hail Holy Queen prayer to Mary. The U.S. Conference of the Catholic Bishops outlines detailed instructions, including a diagram showing the different parts of the rosary and the accompanying prayers. The rosary can be recited alone or in groups. Some Catholics pray the rosary daily, and many recite it to thank God or to ask for intercession, such as healing or protection for a loved one. Shells and seeds. The Marian Library's collection demonstrates how the rosary as an object can be very personal and also engage different senses as people pray. Some are very fragrant, such as those made from peach pits. Some are souvenirs brought back from particular shrines, such as ones from the Sanctuary of Our Lady of Lourdes in France, which contain drops of holy water from its spring. Other rosaries glow in the dark or are made from birthstones. Many have significance to a particular region, such as rosaries made from a grain called Job's Tears, which are popular in Cajun regions of Louisiana. There are rosaries of natural materials such as seeds, olive pits, or even seashells, including one crafted out of cowrie shells and paper clips. A National Guard chaplain stationed in Guadalcanal, site of a key series of battles between U.S. and Japanese troops, mailed it to his sister, a nun, in 1943 with the message, "Pray for me." Then there is a photograph of a colorful pile of plastic rosaries. These ones taken from Latin American migrants and others seeking asylum at the southern U.S. border. While working as a janitor at a U.S. Customs and Border Protection processing facility, Tom Kiefer used photography to document migrants' personal items deemed non-essential and confiscated or thrown into the trash. The rosary itself and the practice of praying it continues to evolve today. In 2019, a church group launched the Click to Pray e-Rosary, a wearable device that connects with a free phone app to help users learn to pray the rosary. The developers explained that the device is aimed at the peripheral frontiers of the digital world where the young people dwell. Whether made out of glass beads with holy water or fragrant dried rose petals pressed into beads, the rosary reflects the myriad ways Catholics can practice their devotion. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Please be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-532-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.